This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Raditya, your host for this episode, and today we are joined by two guests, Dr. Ian Reeder and Dr. John Schultz, to discuss their most recent book, Pilgrims Until We Die, Unending Pilgrimage in Shikoku. Before we get into the book, perhaps we can start with a little self-introduction for our listeners who may not be familiar with you and your work. Dr. Reeder, can we start perhaps from you?
Okay, I'm Ian Reeder. I'm based in the United Kingdom, and I'm actually retired. I used to be an academic who worked at the University of Manchester, and worked on issues to do with religion in Japan and on pilgrimage in general and a number of other topics.
Great, thank you. Dr. Schultz, can you go ahead and maybe do a little background on what you do and your work? Yeah.
Yes, of course. I'm John Schultz. I'm an associate professor at Kansai Gaidai University in Hirakata, Japan. And thank you so much, Raditya, for having us. We're really excited to be here. Most of my work is in contemporary Japanese religious studies, looking at religion and pop culture, religion and new media, and of course, pilgrimage studies in particular.
Great. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think this book is a fascinating take on the Shikoku pilgrimage. But before we jump into the book, can you share some of the processes that led to the creation of this book? How did this project begin?
Sure, that'd be my pleasure. So I studied under Ian as a graduate student, as a PhD student, in Ian's really famous book on the Shikoku Henro, Making Pilgrimages, sort of initially brought my attention to this class of repeating pilgrims that kind of go again and again. And later on, I would become acquainted with quantitative data by people like Sato Hisamitsu that would kind of confirm that there's this really strong trend to repeat pilgrimages in Japan. And when I left for England and studied under Ian, my PhD work was on contemporary diaries of the Shikoku Henro. There's kind of dozens of these diaries, and the diaries all had kind of epic narratives, but invariably they all ended kind of with this sentiment that they want to come back and do it again, no matter the challenges that they faced. So something that Ian and I have been talking about for years, and then in 2018, we received a grant from the Japan Society for the Promotion of Science. So we'd like to thank Japanese taxpayers for supporting our effort. To be sure, those details are available online and through my webpage, japanjohn.com. But when we pitched the idea to the grant body, kind of the initial hypothesis was that continuing repetition on the pilgrimage correlated sort of directly with authority in the social system. But really what we found out in the context of the study is that like nearly every aspect of the pilgrimage, from history to folklore to leadership even to, you know, basic religious meaning, kind of all of these things are driven in an underlying sense by this notion of kind of unending pilgrimage. And finally, I should mention too, it wasn't simply Ian and I, we had a really nice team, including four undergraduate women who did an excellent job supporting us in many ways. So yeah, that was the basic starting point.
I see. Thank you. Dr. Adir, do you want to add anything to that? Or?
Well, only that, as John pointed out, when I had a short section at the end of my book, Making Pilgrimages, about people who did this pilgrimage multiple times, and I call them permanent pilgrims. And then John, much later, said to me, you know, that's a major finding of your book that, you know, needs to be developed more. And then around the time we started talking about doing a project on it, I read an article by a guy who was a guy who'd done some research at Lourdes in France on the pilgrimage there, where people kept coming back. And he mentioned that people kept coming back to Lourdes. And he said, this is a topic that nobody has studied, you know, the idea of people repeating pilgrimages again and again, except for Ian Reeder, you know, me, in his study of Shikoku. So that kind of stimulated us to look more at this idea. And of course, what John actually went ahead and got the grant from JSPS. I wasn't really part of, and he kind of persuaded me that I ought to get involved in it. And it's been a fascinating process ever since, in terms of doing the research, which has been some of the most fun and interesting fieldwork research I've ever done.
I see. Thank you. Great. So I want to start by sort of talking about the Shikoku pilgrimage itself. Can you tell us briefly about what the pilgrimage is and how it's sort of different or similar from other pilgrimages in Japan?
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's like one of the classic Japanese pilgrimages, Buddhist pilgrimages, where it's multiple sites. And with Shikoku, there are 88 temples. It's complex as to why there are 88. And again, I wrote about that in my previous book, it really developed in the 17th century, although legends trace it back nearly into the 9th century. Its main figure of worship is Kobo Daishi, this famous kind of posthumous incarnation of the Buddhist monk and founder of Shingonshu, Kukai. It's been a pilgrimage that in earlier times was seen as basically a pilgrimage of mostly of poor people and so on. But in modern times, it's become, with motorization and so on, it's become widely practiced and followed in Japan. People do it by bus, by car, on foot, whichever way they want. And it involves going around the island of Shikoku. It's a route of about 1,300 kilometers, visiting 88 temples. You can go in any order you want. The big thing is to complete the circuit of the island, to go to all the temples. You can do it in bits, you can do it in one go, and so on. It's all up to the pilgrim how they do it, but that's the basic structure of the pilgrimage. And one of the interesting things about it is that if you go round and visit all the temples, when you get to the last temple, you're usually not very far from the temple you started out at. And the custom is to go back to the first temple you went to on what's called Ore Mairi, to give thanks for having safely completed the journey, as a result of which you're back at the start again, and some people just carry on doing it.
Yeah, thank you. It certainly sounds like a very significant undertaking to sort of be doing, you know, one circuit, let alone like many.
It takes about 40 or 50 days to walk. It takes... And if, you know, technically it should take about 8 or 10 days by car. But as we found, some of these really serial, hardcore pilgrims who get really obsessed with it manage to do it in even as few as 4 days, and to do maybe six pilgrimages in a month.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Now that you've sort of mentioned sort of people going by cars, and in sort of chapter two, you discuss how modern developments have influenced sort of the way people do the pilgrimage. Can you share more on how the pilgrimage has changed in the past 20, 30 years or so?
Shall I do that, John?
Yeah, that sounds great. Please, Ian. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. From in 1953, the first bus tour went round Shikoku and taking pilgrims round. And that kind of changed the aspect of the pilgrimage because it opened it up to more people. You know, a 1,300-kilometer walk around the island, it's very tough going because there's lots of mountains and so on. Traditionally, only kind of, it was really younger people. Well, you had to be pretty tough to do it. By the time the buses started and then the cars and so on, it becomes more accessible to older people. And we see increasingly the profile of pilgrims in Shikoku has been older and much more gender diverse. There's now more women than men that do it. But basically, yes, it's become easier to do. There's more signage, there's more places for pilgrims to stay, there's better facilities along the route. In fact, you know, all sorts of things that have made the pilgrimage easier to do in recent years. But nonetheless, you still get lots of people who walk it. There's about 3,000 or 4,000 as a rule a year who actually walk the whole thing. So, you know, there's a real diversity of pilgrims along the route, people doing it in all sorts of different ways. And of course, we explain all of that in the book and in the previous book too. So, you know, if you want to know more about that, you got to get the book to do, you've got to get the book and read it, you know.
Definitely. Yeah, please, for our listeners, please do.
It's in paperback, you know.
And Raditya, in terms of trends too, it's kind of worthy of noting in sort of the pre-corona space, the number of international henros, we speak about this in the book, the number of international pilgrims was increasing, and invariably almost all of them are walkers. As the overall number of pilgrims has kind of decreased, there's a little ray of hope that perhaps they'll be offset somewhat by increasing numbers of international pilgrims who themselves can be quite compulsive about returning and doing it again and again.
Yeah, indeed, certainly. Thank you. So, you know, now that we sort of know that there are multiple ways of sort of doing the pilgrimage, as sort of someone doing ethnography myself, I'm really interested to hear how you encounter these pilgrims. So can you maybe share a little more on the methods that you sort of took for this specific project?
Yeah. To be sure. It's a pleasure. I think, Raditya, I think one thing both Ian and I have is kind of a genuine enthusiasm for the discipline of religious studies because of its, you know, sort of methodological diversity, kind of flexibility and openness. And I think a project like this, you can really see why having like a nice toolkit, a range of tools and a nice range of data really sort of illuminates the phenomena in ways that maybe if you were just a little more centered on a single method, you just wouldn't get that. So, so I think we share that enthusiasm. So, in terms of our methods, absolutely, we have this kind of synergistic mix of historical, textual, and field-based methods, to be sure, which would include things like in-depth interviews. Just pretty much anyone who would talk to us about this phenomenon, we would speak to pilgrims, of course, priests, administrators for the journey. We conducted a survey that was available online. We conducted surveys by mail. And, you know, just getting a general feel of the social system through more ethnographic methods. But I think with respect to this research, you could appreciate just how much sort of the visual culture of the pilgrimage sort of impacted us and how we can see the phenomenon of endless pilgrimage or continuing pilgrimage in the visual culture. So things like, you know, commemorative statues that mark milestone numbers of circuits, maybe 100 circuits or more. The famous Osamefuda, the colored pilgrim name slips, These become even religious objects in and of themselves that people worship even after these sort of repeating pilgrims die. So those kinds of things. The red ink that is left from the stamps that people receive at sacred sites. So in a pilgrim stamp book or on a shirt is sort of indicative of this sort of phenomenon. So I think in general, what I love about our approach is it employs many different kind of methodological tools. But yeah, as Ian was saying, I think more romantically, really, I mean, the joy of the work was really the kind of stalking and accosting pilgrims in the field. And, you know, I think about, we would start days with kind of no idea who we might encounter, who we might talk with. I think in the context of a single day, sometimes the direction of our analysis changed just based on a few seminal individuals that we met and talked to. And I think several times, you know, Ian and I would find ourselves in situations and we would kind of look at each other and be like, wow, you know, is this really happening? It would be almost surreal. The individuals we encounter and just the incredible enthusiasm these people would have for the phenomenon. So, Raditya, I think every graduate student dreams of like field work as being a sort of adventure. I think it rarely is, but maybe this is one case when it really kind of felt like that.
Yeah. Can I just add in on that? Yeah. Initially there was a lot of we went through a lot of texts and so on, because we've got records of people back in the 17th century doing it multiple times. So we were able to trace a history of multiple performance from the historical roots of the pilgrimage. So we're showing how it was embedded in the pilgrimage from very early on. And then, as John said, we noted as we went round the pilgrimage route, we went round by car, we walked to bits of it, and we actually slept out on the pilgrimage route as well as part of the field work, because some of the pilgrims do that as well. And we noted that, you know, some pilgrims put up commemorative markers to say they'd done 88 or 100 or 200 or whatever pilgrimages. So we did a lot of epigraphic work. And of course, we did a lot of field work. We got the addresses and names of people who'd done it hundreds of times from the footer that they left at the temples. We were very fortunate that some of the temples helped show it, you know, cooperated with us on this. And then, of course, we did basic field work, which involves hanging around on the pilgrimage route, going around the pilgrimage route, accosting pilgrims, talking to pilgrims, discussing. And also, we did a number of depth interviews away from the pilgrimage route with different pilgrims who told us their life stories and so on, that went on for hours sometimes, that we could flesh out these whole stories. So it was a wide diversity of approaches. Okay.
Certainly, yeah. Thank you so much. It's always fascinating sort of hear a little bit more in like the behind the scenes of projects such as this. Okay, so now pilgrims. In chapter three, sort of focuses on a group of pilgrims, right, and figures that can sort of be considered perpetual pilgrims, people that are always on the road. Did you take sort of a different approach when you sort of talk to them compared to other pilgrims per se? And maybe you can sort of share on a little bit more on the role that these figures sort of play in the pilgrimage. Because as you've sort of explained in the book, while, you know, their numbers are perhaps small, they are a significant group worthy of attention.
Well, as I said, the pilgrimage develops out of the idea of ascetic itinerancy, as we explain in the historical section of the book. And then there are a small number of pilgrims who effectively have continued, like the Hijri of earlier times, to live on the pilgrimage. And we give the case studies of half a dozen of them in the book. And in that, we just show the wide diversity of these people. Some of them are one guy we met that was quite clearly had alcohol problems. And we, you know, there are people who, others who do it as extreme asceticism. And in fact, one of these guys effectively gave us the title of our book because we met him. He was doing the Buddhist soliciting alms takuhatsu near one of the temples. We had a long interview with him. And at one point we asked him, how long do you think? He said he'd been walking the pilgrimage for 6 years at this point as a shugyo, as asceticism. And we said to him, how long do you think you're going to do it for? And he said, shunumade, until I die. And in fact, after he said that, that was bang. Yes, that was one of those eye-opening moments. And then that phrase kept coming up, and not just with the ascetics, with the walkers, but with people who drove the pilgrimage and so on. That's why the book's called Pilgrims Until We Die. But then, and we also uncovered the case, which is a long narrative in the book, of a man called Kogetsu-san, who is probably the most interesting character. He's dead now, but he was both a revered pilgrim in Shikoku who walked around the pilgrimage for years with a handcart. He turned out also to be a convict, a man who committed an attempted murder. He was a poet, a published poet. He was a womanizer, a TV personality, a gangster, and a survivor of the war in New Guinea, one of the very few who came out of the jungles alive. Extraordinary story of a guy who was both very much revered as a pilgrim and who turned out to have this incredible criminal past as well. I mean, and you know, that's a fascinating read. So we met all, there are all sorts of characters doing it for all sorts of different reasons. One guy I tell, we tell the story of whom I just met by, I met by chance and had a really long conversation with, a long interview with, told him what we were doing. And he told me his life story, told us his life story. And he said that he'd lost his job 10 years before, couldn't find another one, lost his accommodation, set out to find himself again on the pilgrimage in Shikoku, and just kept walking, and he'd found himself. And I said, well, if somebody offered you a job and a house now, would you take it? And he said, no, I'm used to the freedom. I don't want to have walls around me anymore. And, you know, so there are all these different stories, all sorts of different levels, all sorts of different motivations and different experiences people have, all that draw them into the same practice, into the same pilgrimage.
In addition, Raditya, there's kind of all these different types of pilgrims we cover, individuals sleeping in their car, those sleeping out, as you asked about, and so forth. And what was kind of remarkable to us is that these groups may have very little awareness of each other. So, for instance, we had people tell us there are no people who live on the pilgrim trail any longer, even after we had just met them. Oh, no, those guys used to exist, but they don't exist. Or, for instance, we had a motorized pilgrim say, oh, all the studies about Shikoku are all about walking pilgrims. We've been like greatly neglected as a sort of a group of people. So it's kind of important to understand it's not a sort of unified phenomenon, even though we speak about it kind of in that way sometimes, in even awareness. Even we've had priests that told us that they were completely unaware of these individuals sleeping out, living on the pilgrimage full time. So yeah, I think that's a valuable contribution from the book for sure.
We also, by the way, we learned, we came across another phenomenon that it's kind of interesting in modern Japan. On one of the early, one of our first, I think our first field trip together, and we at one of the temples, we met a lady in her 80s who was on like about a 40th Shikoku pilgrimage. And we asked her, you know, where do you stay and so on? And she said, shachuhaku, literally sleeping in my car. And then she opened the boot of the trunk of her car and showed us that she had converted the car had the front seat, the seat stripped out apart from the driver's seat, and had a bed put in there and all sorts of cooking equipment. And we then found this was becoming quite a common phenomenon. And we met loads of people who lived, had converted their cars in order to go around the pilgrimage quicker, to save costs and so on, and to do it repeatedly. And at the extreme end of that, we have the case studies of a couple of people who've done it 700 plus times, and what, you know, who've done it over a period of like 20 years, 30, 40 times a year, going around 50 times a year, or even more, going around Shikoku, taking only a few days at a time, doing it, and living in their cars as they do so. And that is, an extraordinary and very addictive phenomenon.
Yeah, certainly. And I do want to go back to sort of this point of the Shochoku a bit later. But you know, the figures of these pilgrims that are just so fascinating. You know, I remembered sort of Unkai and sort of Kogetsu are particularly memorable when I was sort of reading the book. How do people and sort of Shikoku sort of view them? Are they sort of aware of these perpetual pilgrims? And you know, it depends. I know that they're so diverse, but what are some of the common sort of reactions that you've come across when you sort of talk to people about, you know, these people that are always on the road?
Well, I remember once we had we met a shacho, the boss of a company in Osaka, who, very well off, we actually took us to a quite a fancy restaurant to be interviewed. And he runs his company from Monday to Friday. Friday evening, he drives over to Shikoku. He sleeps in his car and he walks bits of the pilgrimage. And he does that every weekend and then goes back to his company and his family on Monday morning. Anyway, he's one of these interesting guys who weaves the pilgrimage into his professional daily life, to the extent that we ask the question, when he's on pilgrimage, is that really his home? And is his business and his family home in Osaka a kind of temporary respite from the pilgrimage? But he was taught, he mentioned these guys, and then he was very dismissive of them and said that they're the wrong type of pilgrim and so on. So we met people who kept saying the people who live on the pilgrimage, who sleep out, they often get dismissed as alcoholics, as beggars, and so on. We found that some of them did have alcohol problems. Some of them did it subsist on begging, but some of them were very, very, very kind of didn't touch alcohol at all. We discuss all that in that's in chapter 3, isn't it? We discuss that.
And Radhicha, I think if you're thinking of, like Ian's talking about, really kind of different classes of itinerants living in vehicles and itinerants living outdoors. But although I think the knee-jerk reaction for some individuals would be to sort of classify the itinerants living outdoors, doing nojuku, sleeping roughshod, is maybe to classify them as homeless or reprobates. There's actually genuine discrimination against them. But as Ian and I discussed, it's not an easy lifestyle. I mean, not only are they exposed to the elements, but they're breaking up camp every day. They're walking huge distances. If you were choosing purposely to avoid responsibility, it just would not be an ideal lifestyle, to be sure. So even maybe the more suspect ones still require significant discipline in order to just kind of keep going.
I should also add to that historically there has always been a degree in Shikoku of kind of repression of people walking the pilgrimage. You know, different feudal regimes used to bring in laws against pilgrims doing certain things and very heavily regulate them. There were attempts after Meiji to sort of stamp the pilgrimage out as a horrible superstition and so on. So it's never, you know, pilgrims have to an extent always been marginalized in in Shikoku, at least those who exist on begging for alms. So the modern guys are still kind of facing the same type of discriminatory attitudes that have been around for a long time. And actually, I've just got an article that I've just contributed to a special issue of a journal that's coming out in a year or so's time about this process of marginalization. But so anyway, yes, there are negative attitudes to some of to these people.
And even as an institution, the Reijokai has banned takuhatsu, solicitation of alms, at temples.
Actually, so, at the temples, yeah.
Yeah, so there's even kind of institutional stance against that. So if you can imagine a basic Buddhist practice being banned by Buddhist institutions, it's significant. You can kind of see the negative attitudes implicit in that.
I see, yeah, interesting. Thank you. Okay, so in chapter 4, you discuss the results from the questionnaires that you sent out. And I noticed a very interesting term that you mentioned in the chapter, the shikoku byo, right? Or the shikoku illness. Can you explain what this term refers to? Sort of how common is this term among the pilgrims, and how do people react to this idea of the shikoku byo?
Should I do that? Okay, there's two sides. People talk, the term comes up all the time. Everybody talks about it. You know, I've got shikoku byo, I've got shikoku, technically shikoku sickness or illness, but nobody we met said it was a bad thing. Somebody, one of the guys in the survey said, you know, that they had shikoku byo and it's great. You know, it's wonderful. I think he said something like shiomase desu, you know. People, it's an interesting thing because there is an addiction. We found that there was a real compulsiveness, an obsessiveness to people doing this pilgrimage hundreds of times. But at the same time, people found it comforting. You know, everybody said, hey, yes, I've got shikoku byo. That's why I do it. You know, why I do 5 pilgrimages a month. That's why I live in my car half the year. That's often it's people, nearly all these people, a lot of these people, the older people who live in their cars on the pilgrimage are retired. It's something to do after work, after having spent your life working for a Japanese company or something. And for some people, interestingly, that addiction that they embrace is an addiction that counteracts another addiction. There was a guy we talked to who said that he was walking the pilgrimage, and he said, when I'm back at home, I'm retired, what all I do is sit and drink. I've got nothing else to do. I drink. It's not good for me. Every time my drinking gets to a problem level, I go and do the shikoku pilgrimage and clean up. Then he goes home. Then the same thing happens again. So his shikoku byo, his shikoku addiction, is a counteraction. It's a cure for his alcoholic addiction. And we found that sort of thing came through a lot. But yeah, shikoku byo, the idea of shikoku illness or shikoku addiction, is absolutely recurrent. And I suspect you could note in the way that John and I talk about our research, given that I first went to Shikoku and walked it in 1984 and have done research on it ever since, on and off, and John's been doing it for, God, you know, a couple of decades too, we both felt we could understand the idea of shikoku byo.
But Ian's correct. The informants tend to kind of laugh and think of it as a positive thing, to be sure. But I think the tendency with a lot of pilgrimage conferences and so forth is to kind of look at the phenomenon with like rose-colored glasses, that pilgrimage is this sort of wonderful force in the world that should be sort of promoted. But in the context of this work, you can definitely see the darker side of things. You can, We have numerous informants that, you know, pilgrimage becomes kind of a mechanism of escape for them. I'm sure there are plenty of informants, you know, their family members probably hate the Shikoku Henro. There's an ecological destruction or just the use of petrol and these kinds of things for sort of route after route. So while the pilgrims themselves might not identify Shikoku Byo as being a negative condition, I think our research definitely points to the darker side of what is normally sort of presented as a significantly positive activity.
Yeah. One or two people we did talk to did mention that their families, their wives, or whatever, these were usually mostly male. Then not all of the people who do it hundreds of times are, but they're predominantly male, some of them did say that their families, their wives, kind of referred to it in a fairly critical way, saying, you know, Shikoku Baka and things like that. Yeah, there is that side to it, the darker side, the compulsive side, the obsessive side. We incidentally, just on that point, we found that very few of these people, the itinerants certainly just in Shikoku, but we found lots of the people who have done Shikoku dozens and dozens of times and even hundreds of times, as we showed in the survey, had also done other pilgrimages, like they'd done the Shodoshima pilgrimage maybe 10 times, they'd done the Saikoku pilgrimage 10 times, and so on. So these people aren't only Shikoku Byo people, they are pilgrimage Byo, they are pilgrimage addicts, although Shikoku is their main line, as it were.
Mm-hmm. And Raditya is doing pilgrimage research, Ian, so he should be careful, he might get hooked.
Yeah, for sure, indeed. Yeah, very interesting. Friends. Yeah.
I was going to say, if you can find a topic that enables you to do research and to travel around and hang out in incredibly interesting places like Shikoku, what's not to like about it?
Definitely. That's right. Yeah,
that's right.
Such a fascinating phenomenon. To sort of go back to sort of an earlier point about the shachihaku, right, sort of sleeping in the car as a way of doing the pilgrimage. How prevalent is this practice nowadays? And you touch upon this in sort of the book, but also in your previous book on Shikoku. Are there sort of noticeable hierarchies that you've sort of come across when you talk to people who are taking this method of pilgrimage versus those who are walking or taking a bus tour?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, people who go on bus tours, I mean, quite often will say, oh, walking might be the real thing. But actually, there isn't any text. There's no text. There's no historical thing that says you must walk it. You know, pilgrims in any culture have always used whatever means are available. But sometimes people say, well, if I were younger or so on, I might like to have walked the pilgrimage. But the only way to do it is by bus. With the Shachuhaku people, this is something that's really developed in the last couple of decades. I never saw it in the 80s and 90s. But people, it's become more prevalent. It's a way people can, you know, do the pilgrimage more cheaply because they don't have to pay for accommodation. And that has expanded also because Shikoku facilities have developed. You've got these things called Eki no Michi where you can pull in, park, you can go and have showers, you can you've got all these the facilities, you've got convenience stores where you can use toilets and get, you know, food, etc. So it's become easier to do it. And that's developed over the last few years in particular. And as that phenomenon, you can now get guidebooks to do shachuhaku all over Japan, but that's become a modern thing. Mm-hmm. In terms of hierarchies, I think the main one we find is, of course, always connected with numbers. You know, if I roll into a place and say, I've done the pilgrimage 57 times, somebody else would say, oh, wow. And then somebody else would come in and say, well, I've done it 123 times. So there is that kind of, one person had done it, a couple of people had done it a couple of times, and somebody else had done it a dozen times, and then somebody else came along and had done it over 50 times. So there is a hierarchy of performance.
And people do get to know each other, both meeting at places like Michino Eiki, and really this could be a good subject for a follow-up study, but there does seem to be communication on social media and so forth, people kind of keeping track of one another more and more often. So to your question, I think there is sort of burgeoning community of Shanchu Haku individuals, at least those people that are diehard, that they keep doing it sort of again and again.
Yeah. One of, you know, people told us that, you know, that there were certain places they met up and hung out, you know, in the evenings and so on. So yeah, they do know of each other, and they often share tips. The same is true of the itinerants, because one of the really depth interviews that we did with what the guy we call Shimada-san in the book, it turned out we'd already Hara-san, the itinerant we mentioned earlier on, had mentioned him as somebody he knew from walking the pilgrimage as another permanent itinerant, and said he's a good guy, and then we met to chance on this guy, and we said, oh, we know your name from Hara-san. So he said, oh, well, you've met Hara-san. So he was very amenable to us because we'd already talked to his friend. We met them on different sides of Shikoku at different times. They weren't walking together, but they knew of each other. So there are lots of interesting social relations that go on there.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, interesting. While we're on this topic of social relationships, confraternities are a very common sort of theme in pilgrimages in Japan. What kind of role do confraternities play in sort of the Shikoku pilgrimage?
To be sure. Kind of as we're kind of looking forward towards the future with new projects, we're kind of thinking about confraternities in the context of like sort of the waxing and waning of pilgrimages, to tell you the truth. As you say, they really drove pilgrimage systems, especially in the older days. In this study, we looked particularly at Sendatsukai. So Sendatsu is a person who has passed a series of qualifying points, including having done the pilgrimage four times to obtain the status, which some people would translate as say guide, but it's an official status. And when you meet a Sendatsu, they have like their badge card. So that makes it easy for us as researchers, because if we meet somebody with a badge card, we know that they're serial pilgrims, to be sure. But in the book, we profile one particular Sendatsukai, and sort of the object of the group is to create more Sendatsu, more pilgrim leaders, and just to continue on the pilgrimage as much as possible. So the Sendatsukai that we profile in the book, they're traveling one weekend a month every month, and then they're completing the journey every 6 months with a trip to Mount Koya. So I think one thing this research highlights that maybe some Ian's other work does likewise is, in the case of, say, a Sendatsukai or even some co-pilgrimages being sort of a primary or exclusive religious identity, where the confraternities are themselves kind of a religious cult, to be sure. In particular, if I could share a memory, I went with the Sanmakai, which is the Sendatsukai from Ehime Prefecture, and we went to Mount Koya, and they were finishing up their 6 month journey. Radhija, I don't know if you've been to Okunoin at Mount Koya, but it's kind of like a scene in a movie with the moss and the trees and the beautiful graves and so forth. And the group including several elderly pilgrims, you know, make their way through the cemetery. And the two things that I noticed that I think were really indicative of their approach is that, number one, there was a memorial for other Sendatsu in the middle of the cemetery, and it was actually rather hard to get to. But every time they went there and they prayed to their deceased brethren as by means of memorial. But then what struck me is when they had really officially finished this journey of 1,200 kilometers, there was no congratulations. There were no slaps on the back. There was no like, oh, we're done. It was completely anticlimactic, remarkably, because the thought is we're going to go back next month and it will start again from Temple One. So although you can find examples such as the Samwakai who are extremely devoted in general, and this is kind of a subject we're interested in looking at in the future. In general, it seems that confraternities and perhaps even the Sendatsu system itself is kind of in a state of decline, which probably has long-term implications on not only the Shikoku-henro, but numerous pilgrimages in Japan. So while they once were sort of the driver of the institutions, they appear to be fading.
Yeah, I would just add to that, there is much more of an individualization going on within the Shikoku pilgrimage. If the era from the buses in 1953 onwards, certainly till around the 2000, just after 2000 mark, was the era of group pilgrimages and organizations. Since then, we've seen a gradual kind of atomization, individualization. One of the things that struck me very much in the three fieldwork periods that we did in 2018, 2019 was how few groups we met, how few confraternities, how few buses. More and more people are going just on their own by car and so on, which is, I think, a very modern phenomenon that you do things individually. We met the occasional ones, and we do touch on a few confraternities, but I think the main one was the Samwakai, which John mainly did most of the research on. And even there, we give examples of people. So there are different people have different motives within the group. But the interesting thing is that's how that group encourages everybody to do more pilgrimages. So those confraternities have traditionally encouraged repeated performance.
Yeah, thank you. Finally, I wanted to take a step back and sort of look at the Shikoku pilgrimage from the perspective of larger pilgrimage studies. So these themes of repetition and sort of pilgrimage as a way of life, how do we sort of understand them in the wider context of other pilgrimages?
It's a great question. And Raicha, we want to kind of tease this a little bit because we definitely want everybody to consider kind of our theoretical perspectives, like in their totality. And I don't want us to sound immodest, but honestly, our principal argument in the book either directly challenges or sort of significantly qualifies every noteworthy theoretical argument made in pilgrimage studies for the last 50 years. I think what we've seen, and in Raicha, I'm sure you've seen this as well, enthusiasm, I think, for pilgrimage studies has never been greater. People are exploring the phenomenon in so many different contexts in a myriad of religious and cultural settings. And we're getting kind of more and more diversity, and we have to really think about like what's possible to express at sort of an overarching theoretical level. So that's something we approach in the book, and without sort of giving up the ghost. Essentially speaking, we're interested in the variability itself and how we might describe that and approach it with methods and in theories. So in the case of this particular book, we're looking specifically at the variable of time. So pilgrimage systems evolving over time, to be sure, but how pilgrims' relationship to a journey is a function of time, whether it's a single day or a 6-week walk, or with many of the people we profile, you know, a good portion of their lifetime. So, again, without giving it all up, we want everybody to consider it. But I think the bottom line, Raditya, I'll throw down the warning. I think if you're in the field of pilgrimage studies, you'd do well to maybe consider our arguments in the context of the bigger theoretical picture. Yes.
Yeah. Can I just add to that, that one of the things that we work very conscious of is the extent to which in pilgrimage studies generally, and most of it, the theoretical stuff has come out of Western studies of Catholic, you know, Catholic pilgrimages and so on. And they have not paid as much attention to, say, Japanese pilgrimages as they ought to. I've been arguing that for a very long time, and that message is getting across now to the wider field. But one of the things that has constantly been the pattern in pilgrimage studies is to see pilgrimage as something that happens out there. The Victor Turner's famous article, The Centre's Out There, talking about pilgrims going from home to another place, so that pilgrimage is set apart from everyday life. It's an exceptional practice. What we show is, and what we argue is, no, it isn't. Often for these pilgrims, and we also know of cases in, like, people keep going back to Lourdes, people keep doing the Santiago pilgrimage, people keep going back to Mecca and so on. We show that this isn't just something that's special to Shikoku. People often frame their lives around pilgrimage. It becomes an embedded, as Simon Coleman in his review of the book said, it becomes an embedded practice, an embedded habit. It becomes part of life. So what we're actually saying is, rather than seeing pilgrimage as something out there, rather than seeing pilgrimage as something detached from home, pilgrimage is very much about home. So we're arguing for a different theoretical perspective to what has been done before. And we're asking people who, in whatever pilgrimage they're studying, to consider that point, to consider how pilgrimage is effectively lived at home. Just to give you an example of this, a guy we interviewed at length who'd done the pilgrimage, I think, 17 times. He was retired. What does he do? He does it every year on foot. What does he do for the rest of the year? He says he writes his blogs, he collates his pilgrimage materials, he makes his prints up his pilgrimage photographs, he reads about pilgrimage, about Shikoku, and he plans the next trip. And he showed us pictures of his room at home where he's got all his pilgrimage stuff. He showed us all these, he came to the interview with tons of materials that he'd made. So his whole life outside of walking the Shikoku pilgrimage 2 months a year was about the Shikoku pilgrimage. At the end of a 2.5-hour interview, we finally managed to extract from him that, yes, he did have a wife, he did have a family background, but that didn't seem to be important to him. That was, you know, that was almost like an irrelevant detail for him compared to the entirety of his life at home being involved with the pilgrimage, just as much as it was when he was on the pilgrimage route itself. So a major theoretical point about it is the way in which pilgrimage is experienced, lived, and embedded in daily life, not set apart from it.
Indeed, indeed. Thank you. Well, we've taken much of your time today, but before we say goodbye, can you tell me what projects you're currently working at?
I'm working currently. I should say that I'm retired, so theoretically I'm not doing anything, but I somehow seem to be addicted to all this academic stuff. So I'm currently writing two books, trying to make up my mind which to do. But one about religion and tourism, and one about the situation of religion in certain contexts in the Heisei era. But John and I also have an interest together in how pilgrimages die And we've done some work, kind of discussion work about doing some research on declining pilgrimages in Japan. You know, the fact that some of the major pilgrimages, the numbers of pilgrims are just going through the floor at the moment, and even before COVID, and looking at that sort of stuff. Tell them about El Capitan and mountaineering.
Really kind of born out of this study, really two things. The first was when we were doing the field work, and I was reminded of how many locations on the Shikoku Henro have semi-technical rock climbing challenges that are sort of labeled as ascetic practice. And it really struck me that those still existed. And actually some of the pilgrims that we interviewed routinely engaged those. So I have one project looking at climbing as ascetic practice in Japan, and using sites from the Henro, but also numerous sites throughout the country. But then secondarily, and as Ian was saying, I think there has been a dearth of people employing theoretical perspectives derived from Japan and other contexts. And I'm using kind of our theoretical basis from the book to look at serial big wall climbers on El Capitan. El Capitan is one of the tallest and easily most famous rock in the world for rock climbers. So looking specifically
in Yosemite Park, you should add.
Yes, that's right. In Yosemite National Park. So people who climb the rock have climbed the rock 100 times or 130 times or 160 times. So amazingly, we see incredibly similar discourse. People saying things like, this is both familiar and sort of novel. Every time I come, it's a different experience, and yet it's kind of like coming home. So this is, I guess, the first sort of out of sample test for some of our ideas that and methods that we came up with in the context of this project. So yeah, kind of a natural extension from what we're doing.
Okay, great. Thank you. These projects sound very fascinating. So please do look forward and continue keeping up sort of these projects. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.